true hope, which can be translated, one has to have written the trial to undertake the castle. Most of those who have spoken of Kafka have indeed defined his work as a desperate cry with no recourse left to man. But this calls for review. There is hope and hope. To me, the optimistic work of Henri Bordeaux seems peculiarly discouraging. This is because it has nothing for the discriminating. Malraux's thought, on the other hand, is always bracing. But in these two cases, neither the same hope nor the same despair is at issue. I see merely that the absurd work itself may lead to the infidelity I want to avoid. The work, which was but an ineffectual repetition of a sterile condition, a lucid glorification of the ephemeral, becomes here a cradle of illusions. It explains. It gives a shape to hope. The creator can no longer divorce himself from it. It is not the tragic game it was to be. It gives a meaning to the author's life. It is strange in any case that works of related inspiration, like those of Kafka, Kierkegaard, or Chestov, those, in short, of existential novelists and philosophers completely oriented toward the absurd and its consequences, should in the long run lead to that tremendous cry of hope. They embrace the God that consumes them. It is through humility that hope enters in. For the absurd of this existence assures them a little more of supernatural reality. If the course of this life leads to God, there is an outcome after all, and the perseverance, the insistence with which Kierkegaard, Chestov, and Kafka's heroes repeat their itineraries are special warrant of the uplifting power of that certainty. Kafka refuses his God moral nobility, evidence, virtue, coherence, but only the better to fall into his arms. The absurd is recognized, accepted, and man is resigned to it, but from then on we know that it has ceased to be the absurd. Within the limits of the human condition, what greater hope than the hope that allows an escape from that condition? As I see once more, existential thought in this regard, and contrary to current opinion, is steeped in a vast hope. The very hope which at the time of early Christianity and the spreading of the good news inflamed the ancient world. But in that leap that characterizes all existential thought, in that insistence, in that surveying of a divinity devoid of surface, how can one fail to see the mark of a lucidity that repudiates itself? It is merely claimed that this is pride abdicating to save itself. Such a repudiation would be fecund, but this does not change that. The moral value of lucidity cannot be diminished in my eyes by calling it sterile like all pride. For a truth, also, by its very definition, is sterile. All facts are. In a world where everything is given and nothing is explained, the fecundity of a value or of a metaphysic is a notion devoid of meaning. In any case, you see here in what tradition of thought Kafka's work takes its place. It would indeed be intelligent to consider as inevitable the progression leading from the trial to the castle. Joseph K. and the land surveyor K. are merely two poles that attract Kafka. I shall speak like him and say that his work is probably not absurd. But that should not deter us from seeing its nobility and universality. They come from the fact that he managed to represent so fully the everyday passage from hope to grief and from desperate wisdom to intentional blindness. His work is universal. A really absurd work is not universal, to the extent to which it represents the emotionally moving face of man fleeing humanity, deriving from his contradictions reasons for believing, reasons for hoping from his fecund despairs, and calling life his terrifying apprenticeship in death. It is universal because its inspiration is religious. As in all religions, man is freed of the weight of his own life. But if I know that, if I can even admire it, I also know that I am not seeking what is universal, but what is true. The two may well not coincide. This particular view will be better understood if I say that truly hopeless thought just happens to be defined by the opposite criteria, and that the tragic work might be the work that, after all future hope is exiled, describes the life of a happy man. The more exciting life is, the more absurd is the idea of losing it. This is perhaps the secret of that proud aridity felt in Nietzsche's work. In this connection, Nietzsche appears to be the only artist to have derived the extreme consequences of an aesthetic of the absurd, inasmuch as his final message lies in a sterile and conquering lucidity and an obstinate negation of any supernatural consolation. The proceeding should nevertheless suffice to bring out the capital importance of Kafka in the framework of this essay. Here we are carried to the confines of human thought. In the fullest sense of the word, it can be said that everything in that work is essential. In any case, it propounds the absurd problem altogether. If one wants to compare these conclusions with our initial remarks, the content with the form, the secret meaning of the castle with the natural art in which it is molded, K's passionate, proud quest with the everyday setting against which it takes place, then one will realize what may be its greatness. For if nostalgia is the mark of the human, perhaps no one has given such flesh and volume to these phantoms of regret. But at the same time will be sensed what exceptional nobility the absurd work calls for, which is perhaps not found here. If the nature of art is to bind the general to the particular, ephemeral eternity of a drop of water to the play of its lights, it is even truer to judge the greatness of the absurd writer by the distance he is able to introduce between these two worlds. His secret consists in being able to find the exact point where they meet in their greatest disproportion. And to tell the truth, this geometrical locus of man and the inhuman is seen everywhere by the pure in heart. If Faust and Don Quixote are eminent creations of art, this is because of the immeasurable nobilities they point out to us with their earthly hands. Yet a moment always comes when the mind negates the truths that those hands can touch. A moment comes when the creation ceases to be taken tragically. It is merely taken seriously. Then man is concerned with hope. But that is not his business. His business is to turn away from subterfuge. Yet this is just what I find at the conclusion of the vehement proceedings Kafka institutes against the whole universe. His unbelievable verdict is this hideous and upsetting world in which the very moles dare to hope. Summer in Algiers, for Jacques Hugon. The loves we share with a city are often secret loves. Old walled towns like Paris, Prague, and even Florence are closed in on themselves, and hence limit the world that belongs to them. But Algiers, together with certain other privileged places, such as cities on the sea, opens to the sky like a mouth or a wound. In Algiers, one loves the commonplaces. The sea at the end of every street, a certain volume of sunlight, the beauty of the race. And as always, in that unashamed offering, there is a secret fragrance. In Paris, it is possible to be homesick for space and a beating of wings. Here, at least, man is gratified in every wish, and sure of his desires, can at least measure his possessions. Probably one has to live in Algiers for some time in order to realize how paralyzing an excess of nature's bounty can be. There is nothing here for whoever would learn, educate himself, or better himself. This country has no lessons to teach. It neither promises nor affords glimpses. It is satisfied to give, but in abundance. It is completely accessible to the eyes, and you know it the moment you enjoy it. Its pleasures are without remedy, and its joys without hope. Above all, it requires clairvoyant souls, that is, without solace. It insists upon one's performing an act of lucidity as one performs an act of faith. Strange country that gives the man it nourishes both his splendor and his misery. It is not surprising that the sensual riches granted to a sensitive man of these regions should coincide with the most extreme destitution. No truth fails to carry with it its bitterness. How can one be surprised, then, if I never feel more affection for the face of this country than amid its poorest men? During their entire youth, men find here a life in proportion to their beauty, and later on, the downhill slope and obscurity. They wagered on the flesh, but knowing they were to lose. In Algiers, whoever is young and alive finds sanctuary and occasion for triumphs everywhere. In the bay, the sun, the red and white games on the seaward terraces, the flowers and sports stadiums, the cool-legged girls. But for whoever has lost his youth, there is nothing to cling to and nowhere where melancholy can escape itself. Elsewhere, Italian terraces, European cloisters, or the profile of the Provençal hills, all places where man can flee as humanity and gently liberate himself from himself. But everything here calls for solitude and the blood of young men. Goethe, on his deathbed, calls for light, and this is a historic remark. At Belcourt and Bab el-Oued, old men seated in the depths of cafes listen to the bragging of young men with plastered hair. Summer betrays these beginnings and ends to us in Algiers. During those months, the city is deserted, but the poor remain, and the sky. We join the former as they go down toward the harbor and man's treasures. Warmth of the water and the brown bodies of women. In the evening, sated with such wealth, they return to the oilcloth and kerosene lamp that constitute the whole setting of their life. In Algiers, no one says, "Go for a swim," but rather, "Indulge in a swim." The implications are clear. People swim in the harbor and go to rest on the buoys. Anyone who passes near a buoy where a pretty girl already is sunning herself shouts to his friends, "I tell you, it's a seagull!" These are healthy amusements. They must obviously constitute the ideal of these youths, since most of them continue the same life in the winter, undressing every day at noon for a frugal lunch in the sun. Not that they have read the boring sermons of the nudists, those Protestants of the flesh. There is a theory of the body quite as tiresome as that of the mind. But they are simply comfortable in the sunlight. The importance of this custom for our epoch can never be overestimated. For the first time in 2,000 years, the body has appeared naked on beaches. For 20 centuries, men have striven to give decency to Greek insolence and naivete, to diminish the flesh and complicate dress. Today, despite that history, young men running on Mediterranean beaches repeat the gestures of the athletes of Delos. And living thus among bodies and through one's body, one becomes aware that it has its connotations, its life, and, to risk nonsense, a psychology of its own. The body's evolution, like that of the mind, has its history, its vicissitudes, its progress, and its deficiency. With this distinction, however, color. When you frequent the beach in summer, you become aware of a simultaneous progression of all skins, from white to golden to tanned, ending up in a tobacco color which marks the extreme limit of the effort of transformation of which the body is capable. Above the harbor stands the set of white cubes of the Kasbah. When you're at water level, against the sharp white background of the Arab town, the bodies describe a copper-colored frieze. And as the month of August progresses and the sun grows, the white of the houses becomes more blinding and skins take on a darker warmth. How can one fail to participate, then, in that dialogue of stone and flesh in tune with the sun and seasons? The whole morning has been spent in diving, in bursts of laughter amid splashing water, in vigorous paddles around the red and black freighters, those from Norway with all the scents of wood, those that come from Germany full of the smell of oil, those that go up and down the coast and smell of wine in old casks. At the hour when the sun overflows from every corner of the sky at once, the orange canoe loaded with brown bodies brings us home in a mad race. And when, having suddenly interrupted the cadenced beat of the double paddle's bright-colored wings, we glide slowly in the calm water of the inner harbor, how can I fail to feel that I am piloting, through the smooth waters, a savage cargo of gods in whom I recognize my brothers? But at the other end of the city, summer is already offering us, by way of contrast, its other riches. I mean its silence and its boredom. That silence is not always of the same quality, depending on whether it springs from the shade or the sunlight. There is the silence of noon on the Place du Gouvernement. In the shade of the trees surrounding it, Arabs sell for 5 sous glasses of iced lemonade flavored with orange flowers. Their cry, "Cool, cool," can be heard across the empty square. After their cry, silence again falls under the burning sun. In the vendor's jug, the ice moves, and I can hear its tinkle. There is the silence of the siesta. In the streets of the marine, in front of the dirty barber shops, it can be measured in the melodious buzzing of flies behind the hollow reed curtains. Elsewhere in the Moorish cafes of the Kasbah, the body is silent, unable to tear itself away, to leave the glass of tea and rediscover time with the pulsing of its own blood. But above all, there is the silence of summer evenings. Those brief moments when day topples into night must be peopled with secret signs and summons for my Algiers to be so closely linked to them. When I spend some time far from that town, I imagine its twilights as promises of happiness. On the hills above the city, there are paths among the mastics and olive trees, and toward them my heart turns at such moments. I see flights of black birds rise against the green horizon. In the sky, suddenly divested of its sun, something relaxes. A whole little nation of red clouds stretches out until it is absorbed in the air. Almost immediately afterward appears the first star that had been seen taking shape and consistency in the depth of the sky. And then suddenly, all-consuming night. What exceptional quality did the fugitive Algerian evenings possess to be able to release so many things in me? I haven't time to tire of that sweetness they leave on my lips before it has disappeared into night. Is this the secret of its persistence? This country's affection is overwhelming and furtive, but during the moment it is present, one's heart at least surrenders completely to it. At Padovani Beach, the dance hall is open every day, and in that huge rectangular box, with its entire side open to the sea, the poor young people of the neighborhood dance until evening. Often I used to await there a moment of exceptional beauty. During the day, the hall is protected by sloping wooden awnings. When the sun goes down, they are raised. Then the hall is filled with an odd green light born of the double shell of the sky and the sea. When one is seated far from the windows, one sees only the sky, and silhouetted against it, the faces of the dancers passing in succession. Sometimes a waltz is being played, and against the green background the black profiles whirl obstinately like those cut-out silhouettes that are attached to a phonograph's turntable. Night comes rapidly after this, and with it the lights. But I am unable to relate the thrill and secrecy that subtle instant holds for me. I recall at least a magnificent tall girl who had danced all afternoon. She was wearing a jasmine garland on her tight blue dress, wet with perspiration from the small of her back to her legs. She was laughing as she danced and throwing back her head. As she passed the tables, she left behind her a mingled scent of flowers and flesh. When evening came, I could no longer see her body pressed tight to her partner, but against the sky whirled alternating spots of white jasmine and black hair, and when she would throw back her swelling breast, I would hear her laugh and see her partner's profile suddenly plunge forward. I owe to such evenings the idea I have of innocence. In any case, I learn not to separate these creatures bursting with violent energy from the sky where their desires whirl. In the neighborhood movies in Algiers, peppermint lozenges are sometimes sold with, stamped in red, all that is necessary to the awakening of love. 1. Questions. When will you marry me? Do you love me? And 2. Replies. Madly, next spring. After having prepared the way, you pass them to your neighbor, who answers likewise, or else turns a deaf ear. At Bellecour, marriages have been arranged this way, and whole lives been pledged by the mere exchange of peppermint lozenges. And this really depicts the childlike people of this region. The distinguishing mark of youth is perhaps a magnificent vocation for facile joys. But above all, it is a haste to live that borders on waste. At Bellecour, as at Bab el Oued, people get married young. They go to work early, and in 10 years exhaust the experience of a lifetime. A 30-year-old workman has already played all the cards in his hand. He awaits the end between his wife and his children. His joys have been sudden and merciless, as has been his life. One realizes that he is born of this country where everything is given to be taken away. In that plenty and profusion, life follows the sweep of great passions, sudden, exacting, and generous. It is not to be built up, but to be burned up. Stopping to think and becoming better are out of the question. The notion of hell, for instance, is merely a funny joke here. Such imaginings are allowed only to the very virtuous. And I really think that virtue is a meaningless word in all Algeria. Not that these men lack principles. They have their code, and a very special one. You are not disrespectful to your mother. You see that your wife is respected in the street. You show consideration for a pregnant woman. You don't double up on an adversary because that looks bad. Whoever does not observe these elementary commandments is not a man, and the question is decided. This strikes me as fair and strong. There are still many of us who automatically observe this code of the street, the only disinterested one I know. But at the same time, the shopkeeper's ethics are unknown. I've always seen faces around me filled with pity at the sight of a man between two policemen. and before knowing whether the man had stolen, killed his father, or was merely a nonconformist, they would say, "The poor fellow," or else with a hint of admiration, "He's a pirate, all right." There are races born for pride and life. They are the ones that nourish the strangest vocation for boredom. It is also among them that the attitude toward death is the most repulsive. Aside from sensual pleasure, the amusements of this race are among the silliest. A society of bowlers and association banquets, the 3-franc movies and parish feasts, have for years provided the recreation of those over 30. Algiers Sundays are among the most sinister. How, then, could this race devoid of spirituality clothe in myths the profound horror of its life? Everything related to death is either ridiculous or hateful here. This populace, without religion and without idols, dies alone after having lived in a crowd. I know no more hideous spot than the cemetery on Boulevard Brou, opposite one of the most beautiful landscapes in the world. An accumulation of bad taste among the black fencings allows a dreadful melancholy to rise from the spot where death shows her true likeness. Everything fades, say the heart-shaped ex votos, except memory. And all insist on that paltry eternity provided us cheaply by the hearts of those who loved us. The same words fit all despairs. Addressed to the dead man, they speak to him in the second person. Our memory will never forsake you. Lugubrious pretense which attributes a body and desires to what is at best a black liquid. Elsewhere, amid a deadly profusion of marble flowers and birds, this bold assertion: "Never will your grave be without flowers." But never fear. The inscription surrounds a gilded stucco bouquet, very time-saving for the living, like those immortelles which owe their pompous name to the gratitude of those who still jump onto moving buses. Inasmuch as it is essential to keep up with the times, the classic warbler is sometimes replaced by an astounding pearl airplane piloted by a silly angel, who, without regard for logic, is provided with an impressive pair of wings. Yet how to bring out that these images of death are never separated from life? Here the values are closely linked. The favorite joke of Algerian undertakers, when driving an empty hearse, is to shout, "Want a ride, sister?" to any pretty girls they meet on the way. There is no objection to seeing a symbol in this, even if somewhat untoward. It may seem blasphemous, likewise, to reply to the announcement of a death while winking one's left eye, "Poor fellow, he'll never sing again." Or like that woman of Oran, who had never loved her husband, "God gave him to me, and God has taken him from me." But all in all, I see nothing sacred in death, and am well aware, on the other hand, of the distance there is between fear and respect. Everything here suggests the horror of dying in a country that invites one to live, and yet it is under the very walls of this cemetery that the young of Belcourt have their assignations and that the girls offer themselves to kisses and caresses. I am well aware that such a race cannot be accepted by all. Here intelligence has no place as in Italy. This race is indifference to the mind. It has a cult for and admiration of the body. Whence its strength, its innocent cynicism, and a puerile vanity, which explains why it is so severely judged. It is commonly blamed for its mentality, that is, a way of seeing and of living. And it is true that a certain intensity of life is inseparable from injustice. Yet here is a race without past, without tradition, and yet not without poetry, but a poetry whose quality I know well, harsh, carnal, far from tenderness, that of their very sky, the only one in truth to move me and bring me inner peace. The contrary of a civilized nation is a creative nation. I have the mad hope that, without knowing it perhaps, these barbarians lounging on beaches are actually modeling the image of a culture in which the greatness of man will at last find its true likeness. This race, wholly cast into its present, lives without myths, without solace. It has put all its possessions on this earth, and therefore remains without defense against death. All the gifts of physical beauty have been lavished on it, and with them the strange avidity that always accompanies that wealth without future. Everything that is done here shows a horror of stability and a disregard for the future. People are in haste to live, and if an art were to be born here, it would obey that hatred of permanence that made the Dorians fashion their first column in wood. And yet, yes, One can find measure as well as excess in the violent and keen face of this race, in this summer sky with nothing tender in it, before which all truths can be uttered, and on which no deceptive divinity has traced the signs of hope or of redemption. Between this sky and these faces turned toward it, nothing on which to hang a mythology, a literature, an ethic, or a religion, but stones, flesh, stars, and those truths the hand can touch. To feel one's attachment to a certain region, one's love for a certain group of men, to know that there is always a spot where one's heart will feel at peace, these are many certainties for a single human life, and yet this is not enough. But at certain moments everything yearns for that spiritual home. Yes, we must go back there, there indeed. Is there anything odd in finding on earth that union that Plotinus longed for? Unity is expressed here in terms of sun and sea. The heart is sensitive to it through a certain savor of flesh which constitutes its bitterness and its grandeur. I learn that there is no superhuman happiness, no eternity outside the sweep of days. These paltry and essential belongings, these relative truths, are the only ones to stir me. As for the others, the ideal truths, I have not enough soul to understand them. Not that one must be an animal, but I find no meaning in the happiness of angels. I know simply that this sky will last longer than I. And what shall I call eternity, except what will continue after my death? I am not expressing here the creature's satisfaction with this condition. It is quite a different matter. It is not always easy to be a man, still less to be a pure man. But being pure is recovering that spiritual home where one can feel the world's relationship, where one's pulse beats coincide with the violent throbbing of the 2 o'clock sun. It is well known that one's native land is always recognized at the moment of losing it. For those who are too uneasy about themselves, their native land is the one that negates them. I should not like to be brutal or seem extravagant, but after all, what negates me in this life is first of all what kills me. Everything that exalts life at the same time increases its absurdity. In the Algerian summer, I learned that one thing only is more tragic than suffering, and that is the life of a happy man. But it may be also the way to a greater life, because it leads to not cheating. Many, in fact, feign love of life to evade love itself. They try their skill at enjoyment and at indulging in experiences. But this is illusory. It requires a rare vocation to be a sensualist. The life of a man is fulfilled without the aid of his mind, with its backward and forward movements, at one and the same time its solitude and its presences. To see the men of Belcourt working, protecting their wives and children, and often without a reproach, I think one can feel a secret shame. To be sure, I have no illusions about it. There is not much love in the lives I am speaking of. I ought to say that not much remains, but at least they have evaded nothing. There are words I have never really understood, such as sin. Yet I believe these men have never sinned against life. For if there is a sin against life, it consists perhaps not so much in despairing of life as in hoping for another life and in eluding the implacable grandeur of this life. These men have not cheated. Gods of summer they were at 20 by their enthusiasm for life, and they still are, deprived of all hope. I've seen 2 of them die. They were full of horror, but silent. It is better thus. From Pandora's box, where all the ills of humanity swarmed, the Greeks drew out hope after all the others, as the most dreadful of all. I know no more stirring symbol. For contrary to the general belief, hope equals resignation, and to live is not to resign oneself. This, at least, is the bitter lesson of Algerian summers. But already the season is wavering, and summer totters. The first September rains, after such violence and hardening, are like the liberated earth's first tears, as if for a few days this country tried its hand at tenderness. Yet at the same period the carob trees cover all of Algeria with a scent of love. In the evening, or after the rain, the whole earth, its womb moist with a seed redolent of bitter almond, rests after having given herself to the sun all summer long. And again that scent hallows the union of man and earth, and awakens in us the only really virile love in this world. ephemeral, and noble. 1936. The Minotaur, or The Stop in Oran, for Pierre Galindo. This essay dates from 1939. The reader will have to bear this in mind to judge of the present-day Oran. Impassioned protests from that beautiful city assure me, as a matter of fact, that all the imperfections have been, or will be, remedied. On the other hand, the beauties extolled in this essay have been jealously respected. Happy and realistic city, Oran has no further need of writers. She is awaiting tourists. 1953. There are no more deserts. There are no more islands. Yet there is a need for them. In order to understand the world, one has to turn away from it on occasion. In order to serve men better, one has to hold them at a distance for a time. But where can one find the solitude necessary to vigor, the deep breath in which the mind collects itself and courage gauges its strength? There remain big cities. Simply, certain conditions are required. The cities Europe offers us are too full of the din of the past. A practiced ear can make out the flapping of wings, fluttering of souls. The giddy whirl of centuries, of revolutions, of fame can be felt there. There one cannot forget that the Occident was forged in a series of uproars. All that does not make for enough silence. Paris is often a desert for the heart, but at certain moments from the heights of Père Lachaise there blows a revolutionary wind that suddenly fills that desert with flags and fallen glories. So it is with certain Spanish towns, with Florence or with Prague. Salzburg would be peaceful without Mozart. But from time to time there rings out over the Salzach the great proud cry of Don Juan as he plunges toward hell. Vienna seems more silent. She is a youngster among cities. Her stones are no older than 3 centuries, and their youth is ignorant of melancholy. But Vienna stands at a crossroads of history. Around her echoes the clash of empires. Certain evenings when the sky is suffused with blood, the stone horses on the ring monuments seem to take wing. In that fleeting moment when everything is reminiscent of power and history, can be distinctly heard, under the charge of the Polish squadrons, the crashing fall of the Ottoman Empire. That does not make for enough silence either. To be sure, it is just that solitude amid others that men come looking for in European cities, at least men with a purpose in life. There they can choose their company, take it or leave it. How many minds have been tempered in the trip between their hotel room and the old stones of the Île Saint-Louis? It is true that others have died there of isolation. As for the first, at any rate, there they found their reasons for growing and asserting themselves. They were alone, and they weren't alone. Centuries of history and beauty, the ardent testimony of 1,000 lives of the past, accompanied them along the Seine, and spoke to them both of traditions and of conquests. But their youth urged them to invite such company. There comes a time, there come periods, when it is unwelcome. "It's between us two," exclaims Rastignac, facing the vast mustiness of Paris. "Two, yes, but that is still too many." The desert itself has assumed significance. It has been glutted with poetry. For all the world's sorrows, it is a hallowed spot. But at certain moments, the heart wants nothing so much as spots devoid of poetry. Descartes, planning to meditate, chose his desert, the most mercantile city of his era. There he found his solitude and the occasion for perhaps the greatest of our virile poems. The first precept was never to accept anything as true unless I knew it to be obviously so. It is possible to have less ambition and the same nostalgia. But during the last 3 centuries, Amsterdam has spawned museums. In order to flee poetry and yet recapture the peace of stones, other deserts are needed, other spots without soul and without reprieve. Oran is one of these. The street. I've often heard the people of Oran complain, "There is no interesting circle." No, indeed. You wouldn't want one. A few right-thinking people tried to introduce the customs of another world into this desert, faithful to the principle that it is impossible to advance art or ideas without grouping together. The result is such that the only instructive circles remain those of poker players, boxing enthusiasts, bowlers, and the local associations. There, at least, the unsophisticated prevails. After all, there exists a certain nobility that does not lend itself to the lofty. It is sterile by nature. And those who want to find it leave the circles and go out into the street. The streets of Oran are doomed to dust, pebbles, and heat. If it rains, there is a deluge and a sea of mud. But rain or shine, the shops have the same extravagant and absurd look. All the bad taste of Europe and the Orient has managed to converge in them. One finds helter-skelter, marble greyhounds, ballerinas with swans, versions of Diana the Huntress and Green Galilite, discus-throwers and reapers, everything that is used for birthday and wedding gifts, the whole race of painful figurines constantly called forth by a commercial and playful genie on our mantelpieces. But such perseverance in bad taste takes on a Baroque aspect that makes one forgive all. Here, presented in a casket of dust, are the contents of a show window. Frightful plaster models of deformed feet. A group of Rembrandt drawings, sacrificed at 150 francs each. Practical jokes, tricolored wallets, an 18th-century pastel, a mechanical donkey made of plush, bottles of Provence water for preserving green olives, and a wretched wooden virgin with an indecent smile. So that no one can go away ignorant, the management has propped at its base a card saying, "Wooden Virgin." There can be found in Oran, 1. Cafes with filth-glazed counters sprinkled with the legs and wings of flies, the proprietor always smiling despite his always empty café. A small black coffee used to cost 12 sous and a large one 18. 2. Photographer's studios, where there has been no progress in technique since the invention of sensitized paper. They exhibit a strange fauna impossible to encounter in the streets, from the pseudo-sailor leaning on a console table to the marriageable girl, badly dressed and arms dangling, standing in front of a sylvan background. It is possible to assume that these are not portraits from life. They are creations. 3. An edifying abundance of funeral establishments. It is not that people die more in Oran than elsewhere, but I fancy merely that more is made of it. The attractive naivete of this nation of merchants is displayed even in their advertising. I read in the handbill of an Oran movie theater the advertisement for a third-rate film. I note the adjectives sumptuous, splendid, extraordinary, amazing, staggering, and tremendous. At the end, the management informs the public of the considerable sacrifices it has undertaken to be able to present this startling realization. Nevertheless, the price of tickets will not be increased. It would be wrong to assume that this is merely a manifestation of that love of exaggeration characteristic of the South. Rather, the authors of this marvelous handbill are revealing their sense of psychology. It is essential to overcome the indifference and profound apathy felt in this country the moment there is any question of choosing between two shows, two careers, and often even two women. People make up their minds only when forced to do so. And advertising is well aware of this. It will assume American proportions, having the same reasons both here and there for getting desperate. The streets of Oran inform us as to the two essential pleasures of the local youth: getting one's shoes shined, and displaying those same shoes on the boulevard. In order to have a clear idea of the first of these delights, one has to entrust one's shoes, at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, to the shoe shiners in Boulevard Gallieni. Perched on high armchairs, one can enjoy that peculiar satisfaction produced, even upon a rank outsider, by the sight of men in love with their job, as the shoe shiners of Oran obviously are. Everything is worked over in detail. Several brushes, three kinds of cloths, the polish mixed with gasoline. One might think the operation is finished when a perfect shine comes to life under the soft brush. But the same insistent hand covers the glossy surface again with polish, rubs it, dulls it, makes the cream penetrate the heart of the leather, and then brings forth, under the same brush, a double and really definitive gloss sprung from the depths of the leather. The wonders achieved in this way are then exhibited to the connoisseurs. In order to appreciate such pleasures of the boulevard, you ought to see the masquerade of youth taking place every evening on the main arteries of the city. Between the ages of 16 and 20, the young people of Oran society borrow their models of elegance from American films and put on their fancy dress before going out to dinner. With wavy, oiled hair protruding from under a felt hat slanted over the left ear and peaked over the right eye, the neck encircled by a collar big enough to accommodate the straggling hair, the microscopic knot of the necktie kept in place by a regulation pin, with thigh-length coat and waist close to the hips, with light-colored and noticeably short trousers, with dazzlingly shiny triple-soled shoes. Every evening those youths make the sidewalks ring with their metal-tipped shoes. In all things they are bent on imitating the bearing, forthrightness, and superiority of Mr. Clark Gable. For this reason the local carpers commonly nicknamed those youths, by favor of a casual pronunciation, Clarks. At any rate, the main boulevards of Oran are invaded late in the afternoon by an army of attractive adolescents who go to the greatest trouble to look like a bad lot. Inasmuch as the girls of Oran feel traditionally engaged to these soft-hearted gangsters, they likewise flaunt the makeup and elegance of popular American actresses. Consequently, the same wits call them Marlenas. Thus, on the evening boulevards, when the sound of birds rises skyward from the palm trees, dozens of Clarks and Marlenas meet, eye and size up one another, happy to be alive and to cut a figure, indulging for an hour in the intoxication of perfect existences. There can then be witnessed, the jealous say, the meetings of the American Commission. But in these words lies the bitterness of those over 30 who have no connection with such diversions. They fail to appreciate those daily congresses of youth and romance. These are, in truth, the parliaments of birds that are met in Hindu literature. But no one on the boulevards of Oran debates the problem of being or worries about the way to perfection. There remains nothing but flappings of wings, plumed struttings, coquettish and victorious graces, a great burst of carefree song that disappears with the night. From here I can hear Khlistakov. I shall soon have to be concerned with something lofty. Alas, he is quite capable of it. If he were urged, he would people this desert within a few years. But for the moment, a somewhat secret soul must liberate itself in this facile city, with its parade of painted girls, unable, nevertheless, to simulate emotion, feigning coyness so badly that the pretense is immediately obvious. Be concerned with something lofty. Just see. Santa Cruz cut out of the rock, the mountains, the flat sea, the violent wind and the sun, the great cranes of the harbor, the trains, the hangars, the quays, and the huge ramps climbing up the city's rock. And in the city itself, these diversions and this boredom, this hubbub and this solitude. Perhaps, indeed, all this is not sufficiently lofty. But the great value of such overpopulated islands is that in them the heart strips bare. Silence is no longer possible except in noisy cities. From Amsterdam, Descartes writes to the aged Guez de Balzac, "I go out walking every day amid the confusion of a great crowd, with as much freedom and tranquility as you could do on your garden paths." The Desert in Oran. Obliged to live facing a wonderful landscape, the people of Oran have overcome this fearful ordeal by covering their city with very ugly constructions. One expects to find a city open to the sea, washed and refreshed by the evening breeze, and aside from the Spanish quarter, one finds a walled town that turns its back to the sea, that has been built up by turning back on itself like a snail. Oran is a great circular yellow wall covered over with a leaden sky. In the beginning you wander in the labyrinth, seeking the sea like the sign of Ariadne. But you turn round and round in pale and oppressive streets, and eventually the Minotaur devours the people of Oran. The Minotaur is boredom. For some time the citizens of Oran have given up wandering. They have accepted being eaten. It is impossible to know what stone is without coming to Oran. In that dustiest of cities, the pebble is king. It is so much appreciated that shopkeepers exhibit it in their show windows to hold papers in place, or even for mere display. Piles of them are set up along the streets, doubtless for the eye's delight, since a year later the pile is still there. Whatever elsewhere derives its poetry from the vegetable kingdom here takes on a stone face. The 100 or so trees that can be found in the business section have been carefully covered with dust. They are petrified plants whose branches give off an acrid, dusty smell. In Algiers, the Arab cemeteries have a well-known mellowness. In Oran, above the Ras el Ain ravine, facing the sea this time, flat against the blue sky, are fields of chalky, friable pebbles in which the sun blinds with its fires. Amid these bare bones of the earth, a purple geranium from time to time contributes its life and fresh blood to the landscape. The whole city has solidified in a stony matrix. Seen from Les Planteurs, the depth of the cliffs surrounding it is so great that the landscape becomes unreal, so mineral it is. Man is outlawed from it. So much heavy beauty seems to come from another world. If the desert can be defined as a soulless place where the sky alone is king, then Oran is awaiting her prophets. All around and above the city, the brutal nature of Africa is indeed clad in her burning charms. She bursts the unfortunate stage setting with which she is covered. She shrieks forth between all the houses and over all the roofs. If one climbs one of the roads up the mountain of Santa Cruz, the first thing to be visible is the scattered colored cubes of Oran. But a little higher, and already the jagged cliffs that surround the plateau crouch in the sea like red beasts. Still a little higher, and a great vortex of sun and wind sweeps over, airs out, and obscures the untidy cities scattered in disorder all over a rocky landscape. The opposition here is between magnificent human anarchy and the permanence of an unchanging sea. This is enough to make a staggering scent of life rise toward the mountainside road. There is something implacable about the desert. The mineral sky of Oran, her streets and trees in their coating of dust, everything contributes to creating this dense and impassable universe in which the heart and mind are never distracted from themselves, nor from their sole object, which is man. I'm speaking here of difficult places of retreat. Books are written on Florence or Athens. Those cities have formed so many European minds that they must have a meaning. They have the means of moving to tears or of uplifting. They quiet a certain spiritual hunger whose bread is memory. But can one be moved by a city where nothing attracts the mind, where the very ugliness is anonymous, where the past is reduced to nothing? Emptiness, boredom, an indifferent sky. What are the charms of such places? Doubtless solitude, and perhaps the human creature. For a certain race of men, wherever the human creature is beautiful, is a bitter native land. Oran is one of its thousand capitals. Sports. The central sporting club on Rue de Fondouk in Oran is giving an evening of boxing, which it insists will be appreciated by real enthusiasts. Interpreted, this means that the boxers on the bill are far from being stars, that some of them are entering the ring for the first time, and that consequently you can count, if not on the skill, at least on the courage of the opponents. A native having thrilled me with the firm promise that blood would flow, I find myself that evening among the real enthusiasts. Apparently the latter never insist on comfort. To be sure, a ring has been set up at the back of a sort of whitewashed garage, covered with corrugated iron and violently lighted. Folding chairs have been lined up in a square around the ropes. These are the honor rings. Most of the length of the hall has been filled with seats, and behind them opens a large free space called lounge, by reason of the fact that not one of the 500 persons in it could take out a handkerchief without causing serious accidents. In this rectangular box live and breathe some thousand men, and two or three women, the kind who, according to my neighbor, always insist on attracting attention. Everybody is sweating fiercely. While waiting for the fights of the young hopefuls, a gigantic phonograph grinds out a Tino Rossi record. This is the sentimental song before the murder. The patience of a true enthusiast is unlimited. The fight announced for 9 o'clock has not even begun at 9:30, and no one has protested. The spring weather is warm, and the smell of a humanity in shirt sleeves is exciting. Lively discussion goes on among the periodic explosions of lemon soda corks and the tireless lament of the Corsican singer. A few late arrivals are wedged into the audience when a spotlight throws a blinding light onto the ring. The fights of the young hopefuls begin. The young hopefuls, or beginners, who are fighting for the fun of it, are always eager to prove this by massacring each other at the earliest opportunity, in defiance of technique. They were never able to last more than 3 rounds. The hero of the evening in this regard is young Kid Airplane, who in regular life sells lottery tickets on cafe terraces. His opponent, indeed, hurtled awkwardly out of the ring at the beginning of the 2nd round after contact with a fist wielded like a propeller. The crowd got somewhat excited, but this is still an act of courtesy. Gravely, it breathes in the hallowed air of the embrocation. It watches these series of slow rites and unregulated sacrifices, made even more authentic by the propitiatory designs on the white wall of the fighter's shadows. These are the deliberate ceremonial prologues of a savage religion. The trance will not come until later. And it so happens that the loudspeaker announces Amar, the tough Oranese who has never been disarmed, against Perez, the slugger from Algiers. An uninitiate would misinterpret the yelling that greets the introduction of the boxers in the ring. He would imagine some sensational combat in which the boxers were to settle a personal quarrel known to the public. To tell the truth, it is a quarrel they are going to settle. But it is the one that for the past 100 years has mortally separated Algiers and Oran. Back in history, these two North African cities would have already bled each other white as Pisa and Florence did in happier times. Their rivalry is all the stronger just because it probably has no basis. Having every reason to like each other, they loathe each other proportionately. The Oranese accuse the citizens of Algiers of sham. The people of Algiers imply that the Oranese are rustic. These are bloodier insults than they might seem because they are metaphysical. And unable to lay siege to each other, Oran and Algiers meet, compete, and insult each other on the field of sports, statistics, and public works. Thus a page of history is unfolding in the ring, and the tough Oranese, backed by 1,000 yelling voices, is defending against Perez a way of life and the pride of a province. Truth forces me to admit that Amar is not conducting his discussion well. His argument has a flaw. He lacks reach. The slugger from Algiers, on the contrary, has the required reach in his argument. It lands persuasively between his contradictor's eyes. The Oranese bleeds magnificently amid the vociferations of a wild audience. Despite the repeated encouragements of the gallery and of my neighbor, despite the dauntless shouts of, "Kill him! Floor him!" The insidious, "Below the belt! Oh, the referee missed that one!" The optimistic, "He's pooped! He can't take any more!" Nevertheless, the man from Algiers is proclaimed the winner on points amid interminable catcalls. My neighbor, who is inclined to talk of sportsmanship, applauds ostensibly, while slipping to me in a voice made faint by so many shouts, "So that he won't be able to say back there that we of Oran are savages." But throughout the audience, fights not included on the program have already broken out. Chairs are brandished, the police clear a path, excitement is at its height. In order to calm these good people and contribute to the return of silence, the management, without losing a moment, commissions the loudspeaker to boom out, "Sombre Meuse!" For a few minutes the audience has a really warlike look. Confused clusters of combatants and voluntary referees sway in the grip of policemen. The gallery exults and calls for the rest of the program with wild cries, cock-a-doodle-doos, and mocking catcalls drowned in the irresistible flood from the military band. But the announcement of the big fight is enough to restore calm. This takes place suddenly, without flourishes, just as actors leave the stage once the play is finished. With the greatest unconcern, hats are dusted off, chairs are put back in place, and without transition all faces assume the kindly expression of the respectable member of the audience who has paid for his ticket to a family concert. The last fight pits a French champion of the Navy against an Oran boxer. This time the difference in reach is to the advantage of the latter. But his superiorities during the first rounds do not stir the crowd. They are sleeping off the effects of their first excitement. They are sobering up. They are still short of breath. If they applaud, there is no passion in it. They hiss without animosity. The audience is divided into two camps, as is appropriate in the interest of fairness. But each individual's choice obeys that indifference that follows on great expenditures of energy. If the Frenchman holds his own, if the Oranese forgets that one doesn't lead with the head, the boxer is bent under a volley of hisses, but immediately pulled upright again by a burst of applause. Not until the 7th round does sport rise to the surface again, at the same time that the real enthusiasts begin to emerge from their fatigue. The Frenchman, to tell the truth, has touched the mat, and eager to win back points, has hurled himself on his opponent. "What did I tell you?" said my neighbor. "It's going to be a fight to the finish." Indeed, it is a fight to the finish. Covered with sweat under the pitiless light, both boxers open their guard, close their eyes as they hit, shove with shoulders and knees, swap their blood, and snort with rage. As one man, the audience has stood up and punctuates the efforts of its two heroes. It receives the blows, returns them, echoes them in 1,000 hollow, panting voices. The same ones who had chosen their favorite in indifference cling to their choice through obstinacy and defend it passionately. Every 10 seconds a shout from my neighbor pierces my right ear. "Go to it, Gob! Come on, Navy!" While another man in front of us shouts to the Oranese, "Anda, hombre!" The man and the Gob go to it, and together with them, in this temple of whitewash, iron, and cement, an audience completely given over to gods with cauliflower ears. Every blow that gives a dull sound on the shining pectorals echoes in vast vibrations in the very body of the crowd, which with the boxers is making its last effort. In such an atmosphere, a draw is badly received. Indeed, it runs counter to a quite Manichaean tendency in the audience. There is good and there is evil, the winner and the loser. One must be either right or wrong. The conclusion of this impeccable logic is immediately provided by 2,000 energetic lungs accusing the judges of being sold or bought. But the Gob has walked over and embraced his rival in the ring, drinking in his fraternal sweat. This is enough to make the audience, reversing its view, burst out in sudden applause. My neighbor is right. They are not savages. The crowd pouring out under a sky full of silence and stars has just fought the most exhausting fight. It keeps quiet and disappears furtively, without any energy left for postmortems. There is good, and there is evil. That religion is merciless. The band of faithful is now no more than a group of black and white shadows disappearing into the night. For force and violence are solitary gods. They contribute nothing to memory. On the contrary, they distribute their miracles by the handful in the present. They are made for this race without past, which celebrates its communions around the prize ring. These are rather difficult rites, but ones that simplify everything.